had fundamental changes in the structure of society, and particularly at the replacement of the authoritarian state by some form of non-governmental cooperation between free individuals.
What is the role of a revolutionary? And what should we be doing today in this era of austerity, crisis, and attacks on social programs and workers? Today we speak with Ashley, a member of Common Cause, an anarchist communist organization in Toronto, a trade union activist. The interview is by Scott Napolos of Miami Autonomy and Solidarity. Thank you for listening.
The capitalist mode of production creates this alienation.
What do you do in Toronto?
I'm a member of Common Cause Toronto, which is an anarchist communist group. I also am a member of a trade union called QP3902 at the University of Toronto, and a member of the Graduate Student Union.
So you're studying in school, basically. You're a grad student, but teaching at the same time?
Yeah, so I am a PhD student in physics, and also I'm a teaching assistant.
We're in the midst of a global crisis of capital, and Toronto is probably one of the main centers of Canadian capital. What are things looking like in Canada right now in the crisis, both in terms of resistance and the general atmosphere for workers?
One of the things about Canada is, as you can probably see from what's happening in Quebec, is that things are very different depending on where you are. While we've been having this amazing mobilization and strike happening in Quebec, we actually have been having a fairly demobilized and fairly demoralizing experience in Toronto in the past few months, where we saw a lot of our unions get crushed, and a lot of the things that we thought were going to be large fights ended up not being those.
Like what? Which fights?
Specifically, I would say a few months ago, even as late as December, we were expecting three of the largest QP locals in the country to actually be going on strike in Toronto. And that included QP 416 and 79, which are the indoor and outdoor city workers, as well as the local that I'm a part of, which is QP 3902, which represents 7,000 teaching assistants and secessional lecturers at the University of Toronto. And really what we saw there was, you know, varying levels of mobilized membership, but basically the same behavior from the union bureaucrats that ended the strike anytime there was any sort of threat from either the city or the university, who are our employers.
So what have other responses been, and organizing happening generally in Toronto? I know there's OCAP, it's been around for a long time, typically active. Are there other projects that Common Cause is involved in, or, you know, mass-based movements building up in the city?
Yeah, so I mean, the members of Common Cause, I think, are involved in a large variety of stuff in Toronto, including OCAP, including the Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly, including, you know, the Occupy Toronto things that have been going on, as well as the IWW. At this point, I would say that OCAP is actually not super active in Toronto. They've been doing some good work around some shelters that have been slated for closing, but they definitely are not at the same level of mobilization that they were, you know, 10 or even 5 years ago. In terms of, like, I would say Occupy Toronto is probably the newest and at least most active thing that's going on right now. There are certainly some problems with participating in Occupy, but that's sort of the new kid on the scene, if you will. Oh, there's also been the involvement of a new group, which is Stop the Cuts, which was specifically formed against the large series of cuts that were being brought down by our very right-wing mayor at this point, Rob Ford. And he was put forward a huge number of cuts and privatizations to our public services. So privatizing garbage, and he was talking about having user fees for libraries, firing huge numbers of city workers. And it was sort of part of all of this that was leading up to what we thought was going to be a very large fight from these unions in terms of the public services that we were seeing in the city. And I would say that it was really the community mobilizing that ended up really stopping at least some of those cuts from happening, whereas the unions really didn't participate in the way that they should have or actually could have in that situation. And in the end, when those city workers were actually, you know, given any sort of threat that they were going to be legislated back to work and, you know, maybe some of them would get fired, they totally caved at the last minute and accepted a deal that seriously hurt their seniority and job security clauses, which actually might mean that in the next 5 to 10 years, these huge unions of almost 30,000 people aren't going to exist anymore in Toronto.
There was recently an airline worker wildcat in the Toronto airport. Can you talk more about these kind of more autonomous activities that happened in the city? What role, if any, radicals had in?
I mean, that's been one area that there has been some interesting stuff happening with labor. And again, outside of the union bureaucracy has been what we've seen at the airports. There has been some participation from Common Cause members in actually running general assemblies in the airports where airport workers can actually come and participate. They actually received a fair number of threats from both the security there and from their union bosses, telling them that they couldn't participate in these general assemblies, that they wouldn't be allowed to have breaks that day, so they couldn't go out and actually participate. There was actually a plan to hold the general assembly inside the airport, and at that point they realized that there were 40 to 50 riot cops waiting for them inside to prevent that from actually happening. So they kept the General Assembly outside. But there have been a few number of Common Cause members who've been actively talking to the people in the airport. Not to say in any way that that's what led to these wildcats happening, but there definitely has been, I think, an increased participation of radicals with the airport workers in realizing that that's actually increasingly becoming a place of labor struggle in Toronto. And one that, you know, actually has had a huge effect. So the wildcat of that happened with the baggage handlers, they actually ended up having, you know, a large number of airports stranded on the tarmac with the passengers actually still inside, and they actually couldn't take off for hours. It backed up the flights for, you know, like 12 to 24 hours in terms of people actually getting where they were going. And it had a huge effect, and especially in terms of Toronto, there isn't a large precedence for having wildcat strikes. So this was, you know, at least for us, when we first heard that there was that wildcat strike happening, it was fairly shocking. And we were all, you know, super impressed that that was actually occurring. And it actually came out of a fairly strange situation. Like, they had already been legislated back to work. A bunch of them had already been told that they couldn't strike. And what actually set off this wildcat was the labor minister, who had actually legislated them back to work, was walking through the airport to get on a plane. And around 5 employees started doing a slow clap in mockery of her walking through and, you know, the job that she had done as labor minister. And based on that, a series of employees were fired and suspended. And based on that, about 30 people walked off the job in a wildcat strike response. Now, those 30 workers were then either suspended or fired, and a large number of other people then walked off the job in solidarity with this kind of discipline that people have been facing. So, you know, it started off as something really simple, people just slow clapping in an airport, which is kind of ridiculous, and it ended up, you know, spiraling into a very significant wildcat strike that really brought to light, like, why this had happened, so that they had been legislated back to work, that they no longer had the right to strike. And actually the end of it was that we had heard that 6 to 8 managers, once the workers had gone back, so all the workers were reinstated, and 6 to 8 managers were fired. And when we first heard that, we were slightly confused. We were like, you know, what actually happened here? Like, was that because the managers allowed this to happen or what? But it turned out that the workers had actually submitted a list of managers who had been giving them a hard time and had been the ones who had actually been disciplining them. And so the end result there was that all the workers were reinstated, and those managers that had been causing them problems were all fired.
We're living in a time where there are more and more movements kind of popping up. People are getting more combative, though in Toronto, it sounds like in many places in the United States, things aren't as hot as we'd like them to be. You know, what would you all say to the argument of we should just all be out in the streets, we should be militants of Occupy, we should be in these wildcats? Why do you spend your time working on something like Common Cause? You know, what role do you see for a political organization in a time like we have now?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing a lot of organizing within my workplace and within my local. And for me, throughout this process of being involved in, you know, a fairly right-wing university and a typical trade union, I guess, even if it is in the academic sector, being in a group like Common Cause has been absolutely essential for me. So, you know, I started off just being a shop steward and mobilizing at the department level and having protests on campus and, you know, fairly typical stuff. But I actually ended up sort of at the last minute in response to someone who was running for a position on the bargaining team who was rather right-wing and extremely terrible. I actually ended up running for and getting a position on our union's bargaining team, which was not something that I either expected or particularly wanted. And, you know, obviously, as an anarchist communist and as, you know, like a revolutionary, I have serious issues with the idea of bargaining and what actually comes out of that. And I think especially in that process, I became very aware of this mind-warping world that actually is the bargaining process, and sort of the de-radicalizing effect that environment will have on you. And, you know, even as someone who has fairly entrenched political views, it was difficult to, like, stay grounded while in that environment, especially, you know, it's a fairly hostile environment, even with people on my own bargaining team. And, you know, just in maintaining the position that I wanted to in that situation in terms of, you know, the ideas of what is a reasonable proposal, what is not a reasonable proposal, what is realistic, what are things you can even ask for. Like, these were sort of charges that were being laid against me all the time by the union bureaucrats and the staffers, and also from the employer, that I was unreasonable, that I didn't understand the process, that I didn't have the experience they did, and therefore my opinions were not valid. And having sort of that grounding, you know, political home base that is a specific anarchist organization, for me, I think it really kept me going. And, like, I was still doing a lot of mobilizing. We were unprecedentedly mobilized within our local. We had a 91% strike vote, which especially in the academic sector and especially at a right-wing university is fairly unprecedented. You know, in the end, as can be expected, most of the members of our executive and most of the members of the bargaining team ended up totally selling out and accepting a shit contract. And me and one other member of the bargaining team resigned after they voted to recommend it so that we could speak against it at the members' meeting. And that was an extremely hostile environment. So, you know, we were at a members' meeting of 1,000 people. The employer had mobilized a lot of our most reactionary members to actually come out to this meeting. The majority of those people had never been to a union meeting before and had showed up to just harass people into voting yes on this contract and, you know, get this strike dissent business over with and just get back to ignoring the reality of their workplace. And so, you know, going through a process like that, having that kind of support and home base from a group of people who were, I think, sort of keeping me in check and also just, like, supporting me personally and politically was essential for me to be able to do that. Like, even as it was an incredibly exhausting and demobilizing experience. And I think that if you don't actually have something like that behind you and that kind of support, I don't know if I would still even be involved or if I even would have got that far.
What about the future in the next few months, even few years, in the midst of this crisis? Where do you think revolutionaries should be putting their energy, at least where you're at in Toronto, or if not further?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely depends. So as a PhD student, I'm in a fairly particular place. Like, I'm not going to be going and organizing factories, or I would say, like, even, you know, my involvement in groups like OCAP is pretty limited. In terms of my own personal organizing, it's important to recognize that I am a PhD student and I am at the University of Toronto, and that that is sort of a space that I can organize within and not get to that ridiculous point of thinking I need to go find, like, some construction workers to try to organize or something, as I think that would be pretty absurd. But for me, I think, you know, I'm involved with the Graduate Student Union now. Like, I've recently become involved in the Graduate Student Union, and that's obviously not a trade union. So that's a very different situation. And sort of having experienced what I did within CUPE, this, you know, trade union with the legal ability to bargain and the legal ability to strike and all of this, and realizing the effect that business unionism actually has on these organizations and the amount of control that they actually have over your strikes and whether or not you strike and all of this, I've become more interested in, I mean, still participating in a rank and file way within the union, but purposely marginalizing and ignoring the executive, especially when we're not in a bargaining year and we don't actually need them, and actually focusing on, at the department level, organizing people in their departments, encouraging people not to file grievances, but to actually deal with it through direct action and marching on the boss. And, you know, I'm hoping that through that kind of rank and file organizing, you know, the union executive will either become entirely marginalized or have to catch up with its membership. And I think that that's the way that you can kind of force change rather than even necessarily going in and trying to take over those positions. And what I'm interested in terms of the graduate student union, obviously with everything that's going on in Quebec, but is really moving towards this idea, and it is going to be a large consciousness shift for people in Ontario, but getting people towards the idea that students actually can strike. And I think right now, you know, people, it was even hard to convince our members that they were actual workers that could strike, even though they're teachers and are obviously workers. So I think having that, you know, consciousness shift that students themselves should have control over things like their tuition. And, you know, especially in Ontario, yearly tuition increases are entirely normalized, especially for international students. Tuition will increase 10 to 15% every year at the University of Toronto. And that's way more than what we're seeing in Quebec. And yet there's no response. It's an entirely normalized thing. Even for domestic students, tuition is going to increase at least 5% every year, probably more. And again, it's totally normalized. There's very little response. We might have a 50-person demo at the University of Toronto over it. And so I think that sort of reminding people that that's not normal and actually getting them to the point where they think that they can resist through a student union that doesn't have the legal ability to bargain, that doesn't have the legal ability to strike, I actually think will be more important. And I think that when you're looking at it that way, it is a lot more like you see with, you know, like a wildcat strike. So we wouldn't be bound by, you know, legal deadlines in terms of strike deadlines and conciliation and all of that legalistic stuff. But it would actually be the idea that, you know, when a group of people within a workplace or a place of study get together and actually take action, the administration would be forced to bargain with us and they would be forced to deal with us. And that's what we've seen happen in Quebec, that they've actually got to the point where the government will bargain with them, even though they don't have any legal obligation to, but obviously for social reasons are forced to, social and economic reasons are forced to. So that's sort of where I see my organizing going in the next little while. You know, there are other people in Common Cause Toronto who spend a lot more time doing anti-poverty organizing and like community neighborhood scale organizing. And I think that that's also going to be very important when we see, you know, the austerity measures be rolled out as they already have begun to be in Ontario. That kind of neighborhood level community organizing is going to be really important, and not in the way where we're going to City Hall and to saying, oh, please don't push these cuts through, but actually when they try to close a community center or they try to close a library or a school, there will be people there to actually prevent that, literally prevent that from happening. And I think that that will also be a very important thing in terms of the empowerment of the people in these areas to realize that they can do more than just lobby their city councilor for change, but they can actually prevent it from happening.
Thank you for listening to our program today. Be sure to check back for more content at miamiautonomyandsolidarity.wordpress.com, recomposition.info, more articles, interviews, audio recordings, and artwork.
Creates this alienation. The capitalist vote.